ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming to you from NAR, Melbourne, on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. I've got my tissues on hand just in case. I'm prepared, and I want to prepare you too, because today we're talking about death and dying. We all die, but how much have you thought about what will happen before, during, and after? What does a good death mean to you? How do you prepare, and what sorts of conversations are you having about your wishes? And in 40 minutes' time, the aunties counsel our letter writer over a secret crush. Let's talk. I wonder if you watched this week's episode of Australian Story. It's about Roz Hervey, the late Adelaide-based dancer and artistic director, and how she lived the final 2 years of her life with motor neuron disease, supported by her family, before opting for voluntary assisted dying. In Roz's version of a good death, she chose the time, location, and even what makeup to wear. On Life Matters, we decided to talk about the meaning of good death, not knowing this story was scheduled for Australian Story. But the timing is so apropos that I wanted to mention it, because it seems we are in a moment where there's growing awareness and hunger to talk about dignity in death. A good death can mean many things, from practical and physical considerations to existential, spiritual, and religious concerns. And with me to take your calls is someone who has spent a lot of time helping people work out what a good death means to them. Dr. Jackie Bailey is a non-religious pastoral care practitioner who provides spiritual care for people nearing the end of life. She's also a funeral celebrant and author of The Outrageous Good Fortune of Living, How to Find the Sublime in Your Everyday Life. Hi, Jackie.
G'day, Bev.
Jackie, how did you come to be the person helping people think about this as your life's work?
I think it largely because when I was 7 years old, which was a long time ago now, my sister, Alison, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And she went on to live for, you know, for another 30 years. But at the time, they gave her 1 year to live. And it sort of feels like I spent most of my life waiting for my sister to die and sort of preparing for that. And I found out later that that's called anticipatory grief. You're living with the grief and loss of someone who hasn't yet died, but you know is going to. So I spent a lot of time just thinking about death.
For 30 living, years.
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah.
From such a young age.
Yeah, so when I think you're living, and I was brought up religious, I was brought up Catholic. I'm not religious in that institutional way anymore, but that is a faith that definitely focuses on death and resurrection and salvation and all that sort of stuff. So, you know.
So you spent 3 decades in a state of anticipatory grief. What about, if I can ask, your sister, knowing that she had that diagnosis and being so young, how did that mold her sense of understanding of death and how she would die?
Yeah, it's a really good question. My sister, so I was 7, she was 10. You know, she was a kid as well. But she was very religious all the way throughout her life, by and large. You know, she had a few dark periods of the soul as well, like everybody does. But she was very religious, and so she kind of offered up her suffering and offered up her potential impending death to God, essentially. She wrote a lot of religious poetry. She did decline, sort of, her tumour disabled her in various ways, sort of physically and with some intellectual disabilities and cognitive disabilities, and eventually she developed early onset dementia. So all of those things complicate, you know, a person's identity and approach to not just death but life. But my sister Alison, she was full of love and delight. I mean, she was full of complaints and annoying habits as well, but she was a person who just loved to hug you and very much just delighted in the moment. She's kind of what in the Buddhist tradition you might call like a bodhisattva, or I'm not sure if that's quite the right term, but just a warrior of love. Yeah, I think that's how she managed to get through one day at a time, because she never knew, you know, when it might happen.
So when it comes to this question, what is a good death? What are the values that are central to you?
Well, for me, thinking about my own good death.
Yes.
Is it? Yeah. Well, my mind immediately turns to very practical things, because what I see a lot is people not thinking about the period of time when, you know, if you're lucky and it's not, you know, a sudden death, or, you know, depends on your definition of luck. Some people want a sudden death. But if you're lucky, you live long enough to be old and die in bed, like most people are going to die in bed. So there's going to be a period when you're not responsive anymore. It doesn't mean you're not conscious, but you're not able to, you know, respond, yes, I want a drink of water or whatever it might be. So when I think about a good death, I think about the practicalities of that period of time when I'm not responsive. First and foremost, I think about the physical stuff. So do I want the TV on? No. Do I want music on? Some of the time, I'll give you my playlist. You know, do I want people touching me? Sometimes, not all the time. You know, do I want to see a religious minister of any kind? Jury's out. I'm not sure. Because I was raised Catholic, and sometimes religion does circle back, at least in terms of the rituals, not necessarily in terms of the beliefs, but in terms of the comfort of the rituals. I've absolutely seen that with some of the residents that I work with in aged care.
And do you have that written down? You know, as you were mentioning a playlist, I immediately thought, you know, people have birth plans where they have playlists and things like that. You have this list that you ticked off, but aside from just now, have you articulated, put it down somewhere where people around you know that is your plan or those are your wishes?
Yeah, so I really recommend you get like a manila folder and write this stuff down in it. One person, there's a local elder down here, Aunty Barbara, and she has a box. She's 90 years old. She has a box on her dining table, which is she's labelled departures. And she's got all of her wishes in there, and she's got some CDs in there and whatever. So, yeah, you have to... You know, you have to let people know. Also, I have an only child, and she's, you know, seen me work in this space for most of her life now, really. And she's like really anxious. She's also seen me organize other people's funerals. And she's sort of like, I do not want to have to do all of that by myself. Like, I've got no siblings to help me out. And I'm like, chill out. You know, look who you're talking to. Of course, I'm going to prearrange this. Like, I'm going to have it all written down for you, exactly what I want. Like, I haven't prepaid it yet because I'm 49 and I probably should, actually. But that's kind of prepaying a funeral is like actually buying a financial product. So I'm not 100% sure about that yet. Mm. But you can absolutely prearrange it now. You can go see your funeral director and prearrange, like, say exactly what you want. You know, your music, or just write it down and put it in a manila folder and have a little note on the fridge saying my folder is in, you know, my bottom desk drawer. Go get it. Mm.
Well, we do have many calls coming in, so let's get to them. Welcome to Louise in Canberra on Ngunnawal country. Louise, you volunteered a hospice, so this topic is very close to home for you. What have you seen in terms of good deaths?
Well, thank you. I really hope when people end up in a hospice that the families are aware of what the person or their loved one would like. But I guess this is more of making sure that you come into that room or spending time with that person and everyone gets on in the room. Doesn't think of themselves, think of the loved one who's there, who you're about to lose, and just surround the person with a lot of love so they know that when they're passing, that is what is in the room. There are times where people don't want to come in because and other family members there, and there can be quite, it's a very stressful time for people, but to come in and just surround that person with love, and because whilst they're lying in the bed, their last sense is that they can still hear what's going around in the room, and just to be pleasant and get on with everyone else.
Louise, I'm sure in your position as a volunteer at a hospice, you see people arriving in all sorts of emotional states,
yeah.
and also uncertainty, not knowing
yeah.
or what to do or what to say.
Yeah.
So how do you help smooth the way for them or guide them to that place that is good for the person who is dying?
Yeah, one message I give is that whilst it's a really stressful and hard time for families, just to remember this time as a really precious time, even though you're going to lose someone, just to be present and in the moment, to be a really good support to someone. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Louise. Thank you for starting off this conversation on a good death with us and sharing your experience and insights from your position as a volunteer at a hospice. And thank you for doing that really important work. Really appreciate people like you when I have been in similar situations. So thank you very much. I want to go straight to Angela in Queensland. Welcome to Life Matters, Angela. You've thought about what makes a good death for years. So tell me what that means to you.
Well, I think I have a lot to say about this, but all aspects of this, but specifically, you know, I've been asked to talk about what makes a good death for me, and that I've considered primarily is that I would feel all of my negative feelings and emotions before I get to a place where I'm physically incapacitated, so that I can love and receive that love and not have to control anything.
Angela, I'm curious, what has made you think so much about this?
Well, actually, to be honest, and to answer that honestly, I would have to say living close to a man and his wife, Jesus and Mary, who are out here at Kingaroy,
okay.
who teach that, exactly that life, we can't fight it, we can't control it, the only thing we can do is feel what is inside of us, what emotions we have that resist that love, either from God or from our partner or from whoever. And it's been a journey, but you know, this voluntary assisted dying and things like this is definitely, we've got to see that that's just a need to control right to the end, and it cuts short so much potential, so much, you know, that we could still be learning right to the end.
Right. What about practical considerations, Angela, when you talk about what makes a good death? I hear your spiritual considerations, but,
yep.
you know, Jackie Bailey was early talking about practical things. Have you thought about practical things?
Well, I've done a you know, that form where the, you know, you resist sort of care that's just useless. So that's those sorts of things. But to me, I don't even need to think about that anymore. It's do the emotional work, because it's the emotions that cause sickness and illness anyway. You know, that's where the core of those things are, in our unfelt, ungrieved, unreleased emotions. And they have long lasting effects and far into the spirit world. And, you know, yeah.
Okay. Angela, thank you so much for sharing this morning. Jackie, I want to go to Louise's call, the first one. And the thing that struck me is it's a saying that hasn't come up very much, but it did come across in the Australian Story earlier this week. And that's an idea of death literacy. And it strikes me that in many ways, we're not very death literate.
Yeah, there's a very strong grassroots death literacy movement around the world, but in Australia, I call them my fellow deathies, where we're very much wanting people to, become more death literate in terms of understanding what you need to prepare and what you can prepare, what you can control, what you can't control. And just acknowledging that, you know, it's literally going to happen. Like, maybe unless you're Peter Thiel or Sam Altman or someone and you're going
to
figure out
how to free yourself
eternal life.
Come back, yeah.
Like, good luck to them. But the rest of us are going to die. We're all going to die. Everyone, you, me, like everyone who's calling in, we're all going to die. And that is worth reflecting on, you know, very memento mori medieval kind of practice, or very Buddhist practice, which is there is a visualization meditation where you literally visualize your people as dead bodies and corpses, and understanding that you are going to die, because it's very hard for the human brain to get its head around that. And, you know, we probably can't fully, but we just need to get our head around it enough to do some practical things like understand. So one, I think it was Angela was talking about the form she'd filled in, which is probably, it sounded like an advanced care directive, which is a very, like, that's one of the forms. Like, there's a lot of paperwork that goes with death. You know, there's the advanced care directive, but there's also, like, if you suddenly have a stroke at home and you're in your 80s and you've put in your advanced care directive, if that sort of thing happens, you know, whatever, do not resuscitate or whatever, but you haven't actually lodged that with the AMBOs, the ambulance as well, then, you know, they're going to come in, the paramedics are going to come in and try and resuscitate you. Like, that's their job. So you need to lodge it with them. Or, like, Advanced Care Planning Australia has all these really great little practical tools. Like, you can put a card in your wallet from them, and like a sign on your door which says, you know, my advanced care plan is on top of my fridge, or wow, wherever it might be. So, you know, just the practical stuff. It's helping you, but it's also helping your family, because if they don't know what you want, I mean, also, I think people kind of think that just thinking about death or acknowledging it or writing about it is going to bring it on. Like, that's certainly
fear,
a superstition.
It?
It's fear, and it's a superstition in the, you know, definitely strong in the Asian culture.
You don't speak it into existence, right?
That my mum was from, like, you know, to the point where, you know, grandparents of mine just didn't leave a will and caused so much drama because they're like, if I do that, you know, it's going to bring it into my life. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, I wish, you know, I could control planes in the air, but I don't actually think I can. So,
yeah. That piece of paper is not that powerful.
No, I mean, you can like do a little ritual to sort of, if you feel like you need to protect yourself from any kind of calling anything into being. If you are a sensitive energy person, you know, by all means do some sort of ritual that creates a protective space for that, but still do it. That's my main kind of advice on that one.
Let's take another call now, Jackie, from Rachel in Sydney on Gadigal land. Rachel, you spent a few years in the United States with your brother who had terminal cancer. So this is a very real experience for you. What would you like to share about that, and also your thinking about a good death?
I just wanted to share it because it was something I haven't seen in Australia, and personally I would like it for me and all my loved ones in Australia. So it was an incredibly powerful experience to see a holistic care, which really was based on that idea of a good death. So just as context, they've only just brought in voluntary assisted dying in the state, with New York State, but they have had this hospice care service for a long time. It's not for profit, but it's got federal Medicare funding. I was so surprised. I didn't think the American system would have this. But what it works through is the family and making sure that the person can stay at home. All those decisions that you guys have been talking about, you know, who comes into the room, what kind of visits you have from medical staff, all of that is then controlled by the family and the supervising doctors. So there isn't this institutional space that you're in where you can't control, you know, the lights are on or off or whatever. So it's so powerful. And it was, I was there just for the last stage in July, and there were daily visits by nurses. There was counselling. There was a social worker. There was a bereavement counsellor who now is working with the family and me after this has happened. It was just such a beautiful and thoughtful thing. And I spoke to one of the nurses and I said, how did you get involved? And she said she'd worked in hospitals and she'd seen that as soon as people were no longer receiving treatment, they were kind of neglected and put aside. And she thought that was so terrible that at 25, she retrained to become one of these hospice care nurses. And I just thought it was a really thoughtful and practical way of dealing with a lot of your questions that you're talking about.
Yeah. Rachel, thank you so much for sharing, and I'm sorry for your loss. You've given us lots to think about, and it's good to know that your brother had so much support and during that time. Thank you so much for sharing. Jackie, I want to come back to you, and let's talk about end-of-life support and care. You are a secular pastoral care practitioner, and you help people when they're in that stage of dying. What exactly do you do? When do you come in? How do people find you? And what kind of questions do they ask you?
Basically, I work in aged care, in an aged care home, and that is a place where everyone's going to die. So at some point, people will become palliative and enter their end-of-life stage care. So I'm around, you know, I might know someone for a number of years. I might know them for a number of days. Once they're getting towards, well, everybody in there is kind of, if you like, at the end of their lives. But, you know, you kind of can get to the pointy end, which is more the palliative period, which the last caller was describing, which just sounded so beautiful, that kind of continuous care all the way through. So when people come into aged care, they're very much faced with the reality that this is the last lap, you know, it's the last stage of their lives. There's a lot of pastoral care is a ministry of presence. So I just come and I listen. I listen to the grief and the loss of, you know, independence, mobility, cognition, whatever it might be. I listen to the meaning making, the looking for purpose in this new part of their lives, because they are still alive. They're not choosing to die at that point, or many of them can't. VAD is quite limited still. I sit with the families as well, especially hard for the ones whose family member is, they've lost by degrees through something like dementia, which I sat with my sister as well. So it's very poignant and real to me. And then when we get to the more palliative end of life comfort care stage, I'm very much there to just sit with the person who's dying. And their family if they want to, but family might not be there all the time. It's an interesting one that sometimes happens. The family, like everybody comes when, you know, the person is starting to enter that end of life stage. You know, they might sleep overnight, all that kind of stuff might happen. And if the person, for some reason, their body is strong or whatever it is, they sort of last more than a few days, you start to see the family kind of oftentimes reduce their presence. So that's a time when I can kind of still be there for that person who's dying. If they want you there, like it's a bit of an intuition that you develop, which, you know, the hospice volunteer who called in before would definitely understand that sense of, does this person want me in the room? Do they want me touching them? I mean, ideally they've let you know, you've got your checklist, but if they haven't, you're very much relying on your spidey sense. Is it time now to step back? And that's absolutely happened with me and a couple of residents now where I've sat with them, you know, they're dying. I've maybe held their hand. Then after half an hour or an hour, I've sat back a bit. I've moved back further away from them physically. And then it'll be like, okay, Joan or whatever the person's name is, I'm going to go do a wee. Like I let them know, then I go and I come back and they've gone.
Oh, wow.
And it might be that they just, you know, wanted to go alone. That's really common. And I always tell family that that might happen if the family is very present and very much there in the room and wanting to be there, you know, sort of setting up a bit of a vigil. And I do let them know, look, that's great, but just occasionally, like maybe just go and get lunch or something, all of you leave the room every now and then, just in case your person is just waiting to go without you. Like, You know, I don't like people staring at me when I'm eating, let alone dying. So I would definitely be someone who waited until everybody had left the room.
Is that hard for some family members to accept or understand?
No, no. Everybody I've ever spoken to about it, they kind of nod. They're like, oh, yeah, yeah, we should. And then they start reflecting on the person's character and they're like, oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, they were a bit of an introvert or whatever it might be. I mean, and they know their person. They know to give them space. I mean, it's not like, you know, the person's dying. Level of like their control is obviously pretty limited on when and how they're going to die. But I do have had that experience where there is a bit of a sense that what is sometimes in their control is to wait or not. Not always, but sometimes. And so if it is, you want to give them that last little bit of grace.
Let's take a call from Jacob in Coffs Harbour now. Welcome to Life Matters, Jacob. This conversation has reminded you of how your grandmother died. What came to mind for you?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. My grandmother passed away, I think six or 7 years ago now. And her passing was quite sudden. It was unexpected and it happened quickly, but she was still lucid throughout and was aware that she was sort of approaching the end. She went into the hospital for one thing and it turned out she was septic and quite unwell. So she was deteriorating quickly from there, but it was really interesting seeing her there was sort of quite a peacefulness about her and there was a big feeling of acceptance with the sort of oncoming mortality. And it was really interesting to see that contrasted in the people that were in the room around her who, I don't think we were filling the room with negativity, but it definitely turned into a place where, we were starting to fill the room with our own anxieties about death. It was a very interesting contrast and she was sort of free. She felt free of delusion in that sort of Bardo Todol understanding of her death, accepting that it was oncoming. And it was quite interesting.
So Jacob, I wonder if I can turn it to you now. How has that made you reflect on what a good death means to you?
It was definitely sort of eye-opening. And I think for me, it sort of highlighted that a release of sort of anxieties about your life as you approach it, if it's suddenly or if it's sort of coming on slowly, sort of releasing control over things that sort of make us anxious feels quite important. And also being able to sit in the room, I think, with people as they're dying or even after they've passed. I wasn't able to sit with my grandmother after she passed, but I've read a lot since about the impact that can have on that sort of understanding mortality ourselves. But I think like it reflected like the way to understanding anything, any fear in your life is to sort of understand the thing that's making you anxious or afraid.
Thank you so much, Jacob, for calling and sharing. Really appreciate you taking the time. Jackie Bailey, before we go on to our next caller who's standing by, I want to come to you. You know, people sometimes are afraid to talk about death. They feel very uncomfortable, or there are situations where people like to talk about death and death planning, and it makes other people uncomfortable. How do you strike that balance on that conversation? How do you start talking about it? And even as Jacob pointed out, it was the people in the room and not his grandmother who were bringing the anxiety into that space.
That Jacob's grandmother sounds like a total dude. Like that's the kind of death that I hope to have, very much aware. So I think for me, if there's different energies in the room, different people, different energies in the room, my focus is the person who's dying, always, you know, obviously, first and foremost. And if they're often caught in this, I know I'm dying, I want to talk about it or whatever it might be, but I don't want to upset, you know, my daughter or my husband or, so they're still caring for those other people. And I don't want I'm not going to interfere with that. I'm not going to take that away from them, because that's their act of service and that's their act of purpose. All the way right to the end, you can still be acting in service to others. So if that's what that person is doing, my focus is them, but I'm not going to be like, oh, you guys, you need to talk about death because, you know, your person is ready to. It might be more sort of, you know, I might exchange a bit of a eye contact with the person who's dying, like a bit of a nod. We might talk about stuff later when people are away, or I might talk to those people outside the room. What I do is just gauge where they're at with their understanding and acceptance. So, you know, I've had a situation where the daughter understood, the son didn't understand. The son had the TV on in the room, was just watching TV, you know, and I just kind of said to him at one point, you know, you might, if there's anything you need to say, you just never know. You know, this might be a good time to have a think about that. Just introducing as gently as possible the reality, you know, that this is this is not a normal visit anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And have you noticed any patterns around how different groups of people might respond to or talk about death, you know, along gender or age lines?
Oh, that's a really good question. Not really. I mean, a lot of the people I talk to in aged care, they're, you know, they're all of a particular demographic anyway. People generally don't want to talk about their death, you know, even at that point. They might, you know, we might have a conversation where I feel like it's appropriate to sort of say, is there anything you want to reconcile? Is there anything left that you want to say or do before the time comes, before you die? And generally, no, once or twice, yes, but generally, no. It's sort of like, no, no, I've had a good life, blah, blah, blah. I mean, right up until the very pointy end, people are themselves, if I can put it like that. And so if you're the kind of person who really interrogates that existential stuff, you know, then you will. But most of the people that I work with are very practical, hands-on, sort of hardworking Australians in their 80s and 90s, and that's not their, like, comfortable métier. So what is more comfortable and what I, you know, will talk to them about more is, you know, their families or what, or their homes that they've left, and that more concrete, practical aspect of life and death. And your previous caller was talking about sitting with someone after they died, which just reminds me of that very physical cellular knowledge that needs to pass from one body to the other when someone dies. And that is why, you know, sitting with someone who's died or washing them, just even just seeing them can really help with that grieving. Understand that physical understanding that that person is no longer alive in the same sort of temporal zone as you.
Let's take another caller now from Chrissy in Queensland. Chrissy, you recently sat with your 95-year-old Nana as she passed. How was that experience for you, and how did that make you think about a good death?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I spent a lot of time in my childhood with my Nana, and she was a very, very important person to me, very influential in my life. She has a huge legacy. She had 6 children and over 23 grandchildren, and I think we're looking at about 60 great-great-grandchildren now. So big legacy. It was myself that sat with her for over 24 hours in the hospital, and then when she passed, there was myself, my auntie, and an uncle. Not myself, because I walked out of the room and I got a call saying that she'd passed. It was heartbreaking in the sense that she'd dedicated her life to her family, and it wasn't a quick passing. They knew that she was passing and no one really made the effort. And it was purely because of animosity between the family members. And that broke my heart. Mm. And then even further than that, because of the same animosities between family members, my Nana didn't have a funeral.
No, it's okay. That sounds
Yeah. Yeah, she was a beautiful, beautiful person who never judged anybody. And to her, she would have just, afterwards, if I thought to myself, she would have just gone, oh, well, never mind. And that helped me get through that. But, yeah, for me, thinking of my own death, I have also got a big family, and I just pray to God that doesn't happen when I pass.
Right. So it sounds like, Chrissy, there's a lot of lack of resolution.
Oh, yeah.
Around the death of your grandma and not having a funeral has added to that. Jackie, I wonder if I can invite you in here. And I wonder if there's something Chrissy can do on her own to honor her grandmother, even if she can't bring, you know, the huge wider family together.
Absolutely. Yeah, Chrissy, I was just thinking that too. If you've had an opportunity to conduct any kind of private ritual for your grandmother, or if that, you know, if that idea resonates at all with you, is there something that you physically could think about doing for your gran?
I actually did. I managed to get permission from the auntie that was there when she passed. She was the executor of her estate, and she had her ashes. Mm-hmm. And I got permission from her to take my nana's ashes all the way out to the very edges of the desert out in Queens, near Nakundra, and spread my nana's ashes where she grew up
with
just myself and my husband and my children, because no one else thought that she was worthy of it, so I did, and I took that upon myself.
Yeah, good on you. That's really good on you. I imagine that was quite hard to do.
It was, but it was also it allowed me to make it. I feel like it was an even deeper connection, because I walked the same country that my nana was walking when she was growing up. So
yeah. That's really special. And is that a something that you kind of do? Is there like a regular thing that you do for your grandmother, like once a year or on a birthday or
something like that? No. So my nana only passed in October last year.
Okay. So we're coming up to the 1 year mark soon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you got thoughts about what you might do around that time? Or maybe that date's not significant. Maybe it's her birthday that's more significant.
Yeah, so for me it'll be her birthday and celebrating her life rather than her passing. And it won't, so the trip out to where we went, it's a very long way.
No, I don't mean going back out there. But
but it's very much a case of, you know, spending time in gardens and outside, and I loved gardening.
Beautiful.
And
and maybe planting it. You might have already done this, planted a little tree or area of your garden for her.
It's definitely worth looking into.
Yeah.
Chrissy, thank you so much for sharing. And
no worries. That's fine. Wherever I go now, I do a lot of work in my community, and I'm definitely trying to, you know, spread the message that family is precious.
Yeah.
And you need to get past your own animosities and selfishness. And yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
They are often quite fractured at times like this.
Yes. Jackie Bailey, it seems that sometimes, unfortunately, death can bring out not the best in us, and it happens quite a lot. So do you have any thoughts there? Because they are such fraught times, and things, you know, things happen when people die, and it makes the people go a bit funny sometimes. What do you got to say on that front?
Just, again, to be more practical about it, like ideally everybody would be their best selves, but as we've already heard, they're often not at times like this. And, you know, for whatever reasons, we don't always know what's going on for them. But in very practical terms, what we do where I work and what I've done as a funeral celebrant as well is, so in the period when someone's dying, you can sort of set up shifts. So, you know, these members of the family come in the morning, these come in the afternoon. I know it's not romantic, but it's at least dealing with the reality that you're not going to change that other person in this last period of their lives. Or if they're not going to show up, that's their loss. That's the relationship that they want to have with your person. Fine, that's on them. But all you can control is what you do, and that's what you focus on. And you, right up until the death and afterwards, like the last caller has done.
Let's try to get one final caller in, Jackie Bailey. Saskia is in Nimbin, New South Wales. Welcome to Life Matters, Saskia. You've spent a time with a number of your loved ones who've died. What have you learned from that experience?
Hello, good morning. I think the main learning is that we, in our Western society, death is so taboo and dying is so taboo that when it happens to us personally, we're totally not prepared. So in the Nimmin community, we want to be more death aware, talk about it less, with less taboo, be with people who are dying, be not afraid to ask what they need. And if we, and we also, for instance, bought as a community for communal use a cooling plate. So if somebody died, they can stay at home and people can visit. So we want to open up the whole, lift the taboo around dying and death. Make it also less commercial, less professional, less medicalized, that it becomes more part of our life again. I think also our fear of death influences the way we live.
Yes. Well, as Jackie mentioned at the beginning of the show, and as we all know, death is a part of life. We can't avoid it. Thank you so much for sharing that, Saskia. Final thoughts from you, Jackie Bailey, as we close out. How do you want to encourage people to talk more openly about their own death preparations with people around them?
Probably just do it. You know, just do it. And if it's a good way into the conversation can be around music, actually, like the kind of music you want in the room or at the funeral, because you might not want to talk about death, but as soon as someone says to you, oh, yeah, I'm thinking of playing, like, I don't know, Soundgarden or something at your funeral, you're like, that dates me, I know. But anyway, you know, I'm going to have a strong reaction. I'm going to be like, no, I want Nick Cave into my arms, like you know. It's such a beautiful song, right? So as soon as you bring up something that someone's got an opinion on, that is an entryway in.
Yeah.
So I would absolutely recommend finding your way in to the conversation, but you've got to start talking about it. You've got to make it easier on everybody else around you.
Thank you, Dr. Jackie Bailey, for helping us talk about it today. Jackie Bailey is a non-religious pastoral care practitioner and funeral celebrant and author of The Outrageous Good Fortune of Living, How to Find the Sublime in Your Everyday Life. Now, if you're interested in the topic of voluntary assisted dying, tune into God Forbid tomorrow on Radio National from 5 p.m. They have a special on VAD. If this conversation has raised issues for you, Lifeline operates Griefline, which offers free support to people experiencing grief and loss. That number is 1-300-845-745. That's Griefline on 1-300-845-745. Next up, the aunties are waiting in the wings.
Australia's favourite wildflower is about to be revealed.
Which bloom captured the nation's heart?
Will it be a familiar favourite?
Or a tiny botanical marvel that you've never heard of?
Join Anne Jones and me, Belinda Smith, for the live Hour of Flower Countdown.
Packed with stories from Australia's spectacular plant world.
Today from midday on ABC Radio National.
Is a secret crush meant to stay secret forever? Let's ask Auntie. And your aunties are journalist and author Patrick Lenton and author and playwright Michelle Law. Hi, Patrick. Hi, Michelle. Gut check first. Hello. Michelle, I'll go to you. How fun is it to have a crush on someone? Is it deeply enjoyable, free excitement? It's thrilling, isn't it? Do you agree, disagree?
It's so invigorating. I love a crush, but it is also a source of deep torment. so both.
Spoken like a true playwright. Excellent. Patrick, yay or nay to enjoying the thrills of a secret crush?
Oh, absolutely. But it is, as Michelle says, it's absolutely agonizing the entire time. It's like, good pain.
What is the line between the titillation of the good pain and then it becoming torment?
There has to be hope. If you're sailing towards the horizon, that's beautiful because you're eventually going to get to where you're going. But if you're just doing it forever, then you're stuck in limbo, and everything just extends into horror.
You're a romance author through and through. I love this. let's get to what Mikey has shared. And Mikey says, I recently went away with a friend who I have a slight crush on. We spent the weekend hanging out and talking and just doing stuff, all platonic. It was great. Patrick, Mikey says, it's a slight crush. What does that mean in your lens?
I mean, For me, it's unrelatable because I'm 0 to 100 all the time. Okay. So a slight crush would be a large crush. But I do know that some people are able to hold, you know, a spectrum of crush within them. And I think there's a slight crush is there's a potential. There, you know, there is an ember of attraction. There is something that could perhaps grow, but they're not willing to, you know, to fan the flames yet.
Michelle, what do you think about spending a, quote, platonic weekend away with someone you have a, quote, slight crush on?
I think it's dangerous territory. I mean, that entire weekend, you're just going to be thinking, what if this happens? What if it doesn't? Do they like me? Do they not? And you'll be searching nonstop for any kind of sign that leans towards the positive outcome that you're hoping for. So I think it's really exciting, but also an opportunity for a lot of pain.
Yes.
So platonic or not?
It's interesting. It's interesting. Let's move on to part two. Mikey continues. I'm a writer, inveterate note taker, always jotting things down in a notebook. I also have the habit of misplacing the notebook. And when I got home from the weekend, I realized it was missing. We had gone on the trip in her car, and it dawned on me that's where I left it. Okay, Patrick, you have already described yourself as someone who can only crush hard. Okay. Mm-hmm. So firstly, put yourself in Mikey's shoes. You realize this notebook is not on your person. How do you feel?
I would probably say something around panic, just absolute terror, because I don't journal myself because I don't want to put those thoughts into a physical place where they could then be discovered. So I think there would be something absolutely terrifying, even if it's pretty low, even if it's just like, I have a little bit of a crush. If you're not ready to share that with the person who you are having a little bit of a crush on, that would feel quite invasive, I feel. On their fault, just like, oh no, this is my private thoughts.
Michelle, same question to you. If you're Mikey, you get home and you realize that notebook is nowhere with you, what's going through your mind?
I mean, probably a couple of things. Horror, but also excitement and titillation. Because I wonder, and I suspect that Mikey potentially, his subconscious or their subconscious has left it there, potentially on purpose, in the hopes that it could be discovered.
Whomst among us has not accidentally, subconsciously left an item behind with someone we have a crush on in the subconscious wish to have another meeting? Patrick, let's hear your thoughts.
I mean, I don't believe that I've ever done that. I think I tend to go more towards straightforwardness. Okay. But I can definitely see that as if you don't have the capacity to have, you know, a talk yet, and you're still trying to sort of lead breadcrumbs to see if they'll come to you, then that can make a lot of sense.
Yeah, totally. Okay, let's get to the final chapter that Mikey has shared with us. Mikey says, there's probably all kinds of damning thoughts in the notebook, but mostly I'm worried she'll see my two honest reflections on our trip together. I'm terrified she's going to find the notebook and read it. When I ask her for the notebook back, I'm wondering if I should mention what I wrote or just go on as if nothing's happened. All right, Michelle, Mikey's anxious, right? The psychic weight of this notebook seems huge. Like, it feels like it's burning, burning, burning. What are your thoughts here? Is Mikey correct?
The fact that Mikey is asking, I'm wondering if I should mention, you know, this notebook and potentially the contents within it, really confirms my suspicion that there was a subconscious element to this, or at least a subconscious intention. I feel like it's an opportunity. I'm of the mind, and similar to Patrick, I'm often 0 to 100, especially when it comes to crushes. I'm of the mind that life is too short and you should, I mean, it sounds like Mikey wants to say something or at least confess something. That would be my thought.
Patrick, you earlier said if there's hope, it's not torment, right? But Mikey seems to be tormented. But, like, what's your gauge on whether there's hope here? I do want to point out, you know, we don't have all the details in this letter, but it does sound like two platonic friends went away on a weekend together solo. Just want to point that out.
I think that's where the fear comes into it. It's, you know, it's they're asking for permission essentially to about whether it's worth potentially trashing the friendship for the hope of something more. So at the moment, they're in that perfect little, you know, wedge between the hope of something happening, but also the safety of it's just a platonic friendship. So it's they could actually really spin out the crush for a very long time if they wanted to. But you know, obviously that internal pressure is building. And so they're asking for permission of, you know, kind of themselves of, do I say something? Do I bring up the notebook? Do I point to the notebook? You know, do I read it out loud to them?
Yeah.
And potentially change everything dramatically forever.
It's a little bit of a bubble. Like, it's entirely possible that this unnamed female has a similar level of secret crush and they're just enjoying that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Michelle, I want to put yourself in the shoes of the unnamed secret crush, right? You go to your car. You find your friend, possibly secret crush, Mikey's notebook in your car. What would you do? Do you pick it up and open it? Do you respectfully set it aside?
I'm a real busybody. I'm kind of known for, you know, if you leave your grocery bags in my house, I will go through them to see what kind of diet you have. And I have done that, much to a friend's horror. So I would have a squiz. And then depending on what the contents are, say or not say anything.
Pause. Okay, let's say you are the friend. You do have a returning secret mutual crush and you read that Mikey has read it. What do you do? What's your reaction?
Oh my gosh, this is the romance plotting thing in my mind. Because I would write my thoughts in a notebook and leave it somewhere for Mikey to find.
Delightful. So delightful. Patrick, you're also a writer. What would you do?
Probably not that. You know, I feel like I would take that as a, you know, as the go flag, and I'd be like, right, okay, we're doing this. If I was interested,
right.
You know, I would just be like, hey,
I read in your notebook that you really, really like me.
Yeah, I broke your trust and read your notebook.
Let's have a relationship.
Yeah, but it's all worth it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Patrick Lenton is a journalist and author. His book is called In Spite of You. Michelle Law is the Patrick White Fellow at the Sydney Theatre Company. Now, if you have a troubling dilemma that needs our help, having people talk it out can be very cathartic and also just help you figure out what to do next. Our aunties are here for you. Write up your problem, email it to lifematters@abc.net.au, and we'll get our crew of aunties on the case. That email address again is lifematters@abc.net.au. Big thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the week. They are Jack McDonald, Bronwyn O'Shea, Lucy Sweeney, Bex Zajac, and our acting executive producer is Grace Pashley. Our audio engineer is Elise Simons, and you can find all Life Matters episodes on ABC Listen. All you have to do is hop onto the app, search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow. You're all set. I'm Beverly Wang. Thank you so much for all of your calls and messages. Let's talk again next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.